Our next speaker, and I wanted to say, yes, Maud, we are standing for something. We stand for another world is possible. And thank you very much for those wonderful comments. We're now going to hear from Andrew Jackson, who's the National Director of Social and Economic Policy with the Canadian Labour Congress. Andrew is also a research professor in the Institute of Political Economy at Carleton University, a research associate with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and a fellow with the School of Policy Studies at Queen's University. During a leave of absence from the CLC in 2002, he was director of research with the Canadian Council on Social Development. Mr. Jackson's area of interest include the labor market and the quality of jobs, income distribution and poverty, macroeconomic policy, social policy, and the impacts of globalization on workers. He has written numerous articles for popular and academic publications and is the author of Work and Labor in Canada, Critical Issues. Please give a very warm welcome to Andrew Jackson.
Well, thank you, and what a great turnout. I must say my dominant thought at the moment is that we should have insisted Maud went last rather than first. So a delight to share a platform with her, but Maud's very much a tough act to follow. I was just sitting thinking, Maud, I remember way back in the first free trade agreement when Maud and Bob White were debating Tom DeQuino on the first free trade agreement. And I think really this alliance between the labor movement, the Council of Canadians, the popular movements around these kinds of struggles is absolutely essential that we continue to sort of act together to block this project. And I think back, you know, this whole sort of project now of the right, of the corporate elite, I mean, these people are absolutely relentless in pushing their vision of this country. No matter the counter-struggles against, they're just absolutely relentless in pushing against it. And I must say, Maud is kind of an inspiration in that she's sort of equally relentless in continuing to fight back. And I certainly have moments of discouragement, but this is just a wonderful turnout tonight and really energizing. I think as Maud said, Atlantica really is a regional dimension of the wider deep integration or NAFTA plus agenda being pushed by our corporate and by our political elites in tandem. And I think this agenda has very serious implications for working people in this region, and that it's a big move in the wrong direction. So I want to just very briefly reprise a bit of the history of cross-border integration as it's been taking place since the original free trade agreement back in 1989, and some of the implications of that, where it's been taking us, and where this new round is taking us, and some grounds for concern and why we should be articulating a different vision. So if we go back to the late 80s, at one level, this process was about tariff reductions, it was about easier cross-border trade, and it was certainly about much easier cross-border flows of investment. And since that period, we indeed have seen quite a dramatic increase in the level of integration between the Canadian and U.S. economies. We saw a huge wave of industrial restructuring in Canada in the late 80s and early 90s, a big round of initial job losses. And we should recall that what this process was really about, what it was sold to us on the basis of, was that it was going to create a basis for growth and for shared prosperity. That's always the line. This is good for the economy. The gains of the economy will be shared. This agenda is good for all of us. But I think we always have to bear in mind that these kinds of trade and investment agreements and more open borders as defined by them results in a major sort of shift in the power relationship in our society from working people towards mobile transnational capital. It's companies that can threaten now much more effectively to move production, jobs, and new investment. And that power has been, I would argue, exercised. So let me just throw one sort of very striking set of numbers out to you, I think. If we take the whole period, and I won't throw out a lot of numbers, but I think this is important. If we take the whole period of the 1990s, so from 1989 to through to 2001, over that whole period, the top 1% of Canadian society of wage and salary earners, and today's terms, the top 1% starts at an income of $170,000. So these are the guys, and they are mainly guys, sitting there with their $600 dinner plates tonight. So that top 1%, in 1989, $9 out of every $100 of Canada's national income, of the total in wages and salaries, went to that top 1%. Over the course of the 1990s through to 2001, that increased to 14%. So a big increase, their share of our total income. And they actually saw an increase in their real income of 65% over the course of the 1990s. If we take that whole same period, the wages of somebody, a worker in the exact middle of the workforce, didn't increase at all after inflation. So 65% increase in real income at the very top, no increase at all for the entire bottom half of the workforce. For an average worker, maybe an increase of 7 or 8%. So there's been an incredibly unequal distribution of the fruits of economic growth over that period. And this was, for the most part, a period in which we did see economic growth. But when we raise the question, who is this agenda working for? How will those gains be distributed? That's almost dismissed by them as an irrelevant question, because the assumption is automatic that growth is shared by everybody. But the reality is, under this agenda, those gains have not been shared. And in many ways, we've seen a real regression of living standards. So it's not just the fact that wages have been flat. The most important income security program for workers, unemployment insurance, was deeply cut back. There's been major changes in the quality of jobs, a shift to much more insecure forms of work, contract work, temporary work. There's no doubt at all that the ability of unions to bargain decent wages and working conditions, health and safety in workplaces, has been rolled back. Since the late 1980s, which was about the peak of unionization in Canada, we have seen private sector unionization, particularly in the sectors of the economy most exposed to international trade, erode. So we still have strong unions in the private sector, but we are down to a 20% unionization rate. Still a lot bigger than 8% in the private sector in the US. Still a really significant, important difference, but a shrinking difference. And I'd argue that's very closely linked to the fact that in a completely integrated economic space, subject only to market principles, that business will relentlessly seek high productivity, highest quality work at the lowest possible cost, and they will use that pressure to erode wages and working conditions. And the other dimension of that, I think in an integrated economic space, there's always relentless pressure as well from the business community for lower taxes on them and for lower taxes on high-income earners. And it's, if you recall the great free trade debate, I think Tom DeQuino in that debate sort of absolutely denied that there was any link at all between Canada as a social project, as being about equality, fairness, decent social programs, that there was no link at all to that. This was a purely economic arrangement. And then as soon as that set of agreements was in place, then the whole argument shifted to we had to become competitive in this new integrated economic environment, and low taxes for business, for the high-income earners, was a very key part of that competitive equation. And I don't think free trade has been the only factor at play or economic integration. There's other aspects to the broader neoliberal agenda. But I think it was because of closer integration that business did demand major cuts to the unemployment insurance program to create a greater sense of insecurity amongst workers. And certainly that drive for lower taxes combined with the deficit and debt was a major reason for the cutbacks we had in the social programs in this country over the 1990s. And, you know, one thing I think is just incredibly tragic is just 2 and 3 years ago, we were just beginning to see the beginnings of a reinvestment in our social programs in the minority parliament, the last period of the Chrétien government, the last minority parliament. And I think now we've seen, again, a major shift back after just a beginnings of a shift in a more progressive direction. I think at a second level, and even more importantly, what integration is really about as well is about reducing the policy space for governments to shape economic and regional development in the interests of working families. And as Maud has said, this also implies a shrinking scope for democracy. And I think, as I said, I think economic integration is just one part of the wider right-wing agenda, but I think it's a very important part because it embeds or constitutionalizes or sets in binding rules limits on what governments can do. So it's not just the fact that we have right-wing governments periodically, but that we have a set of rules confronting different kinds of governments as they're elected. So what are these most critically? I think it's about a reduced ability of governments to tie investment, and particularly foreign investment, to jobs, job creation, to retention of jobs, to investment here in Canada. It's certainly about a reduced ability of governments to limit resource-based exports and to require the processing of our resources, developments of spin-offs from our resource industries here in Canada. And I think what's problematic about this agenda is not so much trade with the United States and the rest of the world, which I think is on balance a good thing. I don't believe in a nationally self-sufficient Canada. But I think what's critically important is if we lose the tools that governments, that communities have to shape economic development in the interests of workers and communities. And I think there are strategies available to us where we can use trade and economic linkages as a lever for development, but that's not what we get with these kinds of agreements which tie the hands of governments. So what did NAFTA really accomplish in terms of economic development? Well, there's no doubt that after the initial restructuring of the economy, we did actually see a big increase in Canadian exports to the United States over the 1990s. And that continued until very recently, which was mainly because we had quite a low dollar in relation to the American dollar. So let's not deny that there has been a big increase in trade. But what's also true and what flies in the face of what was promised is over this whole period, our economy has actually not diversified, not become a higher value-added, more sophisticated, more knowledge-intensive economy, creating more skilled and better jobs, but has become actually a much more heavily resource-based economy driven directly by the resource needs of the world and of the United States. So just to throw one number out at you again, making it more than one number, I suppose, 60% of our exports now consists of resources. Now, it's a slightly complicated calculation because it looks bigger for the manufactured sector, but then you've got to strip out what we import in order to re-export. So in the auto industry, for example, we bring in a lot of components, assemble them, send them out. But if you look at the value added of all of our exports, 60% is now resources. And that has been increasing very rapidly. It's been driven by oil and gas in particular, but by a range of minerals. And my sense of glancing over the numbers for Atlantic Canada is that's been very true for this region as well, that the increase in trade that we've seen south to the U.S. under NAFTA has been still mainly in the resource sector. Now, that's not to say there aren't other important parts of our economy that have grown to some degree, our machinery and equipment industries. But we have, through this model, I think, really locked in a much more traditional economic pattern of Canada as essentially a producer of resources for the U.S. economy. And we do get some good jobs out of the resource sector, no doubt about it. But we don't get anywhere near the kind of jobs that one would get from an equivalent amount of capital invested in other sectors. You take jobs in a refinery in the oil sands, these are enormously capital-intensive operations. Yeah, and one of the great ironies really about NAFTA is an economic agenda. I mean, at one level, if you listen to the business elites, they celebrate our economic gains, everything's wonderful, trade has increased. And then they go off and huddle in conferences all about by themselves, and they fret about the fact that the productivity gap with the U.S. has continued to widen. If you read them carefully, the chartered banks are putting out reports, and they're fretting about the fact that the profits of Canadian business as a share of our economy now are at an all-time historic high, but they're investing very little outside the resource sector. So there's huge investments in the oil sands in Alberta, but I mean, those profits overall are going into just very small parts of our economy. Huge amounts are being rebated back to shareholders. Of course, their answer to that is cut business taxes even further, even though we're already below the U.S. But there really is this kind of level at which, if the agenda isn't working, the only answer is not to question the agenda, but to relentlessly drive it one stage further. So it's kind of, if you're in a hole, as the adage is, well, we've got to kind of keep digging, and sooner or later we'll get out of this. And what's also really striking is this agenda hasn't delivered what it was supposed to do, which was guaranteed access to the American market. That was the one thing that free trade was supposed to do. And, of course, the key case here is softwood lumber, where we've had two final panel decisions on the extraordinary panel, which we were told would never be invoked, and it was only to sort of deal with Canadian paranoia about the U.S. administrative structure. They set aside two definitive panel rulings. They're going to keep a portion of those tariffs that they put on softwood lumber. They're not going to remit them back. Harper's capitulating and describing this as part of the new friendly agenda. And I mean, in a sense, it's really the U.S. has unilaterally abrogated NAFTA. They have refused to live up to the agreement. And of course, it's not just lumber. In the case of Atlantic Canada, it's been agricultural exports, others. So, I mean, agreement or no agreement, it continues to be the case that the U.S. is the stronger partner in this relationship, and when they choose to throw their weight around, that they do. And then on top of that, of course, what's happened post 9/11, we've had a context in the U.S. where security agendas trump the trade agenda. So there has been this incredible paranoia amongst the business elite about how the hell do we get goods and services across this border, which, despite all these agreements, remains a huge reality, that border that stretches across Canada. So their reaction is, of course, as Maud said, not to question NAFTA, to disentangle to some degree, to regain some policy space, but rather to dig in even deeper. I mean, we have incredibly supine corporate elite. They have just a total fixation on deepening continental integration. So we've had the Security and Prosperity Partnership launched by the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Its main aspects, again, Maud flagged, just military and security harmonization with the U.S., major sort of ramping up of the security role of the federal government in response. Regulatory harmonization, this process of bureaucrats and business executives sitting together behind closed doors to regulate, to harmonize our regulation. But also what I place a bit of emphasis on in the Atlantica context is this notion of actually deepening NAFTA to go to to cement a resource pact. So they're talking about much closer integration in the oil and gas sector in particular. So they really want an absolute assurance that if we build the Mackenzie Valley pipeline to bring gas down to the oil sands, development of the tar sands, that will require huge amounts of capital from the U.S. They see that as absolutely integral to the energy security of the United States. So this is a huge part of this agenda now is absolutely locking our oil and gas sectors into. But it's bigger than that. They're talking about a completely integrated North America-wide electricity grid. And water is definitely back on the table as well. They're also putting back on the table a few of the areas which were actually excluded from NAFTA, the most important being the limits on U.S. takeovers in our cultural sector. And they're talking about a common trade policy between us and the U.S., which is profoundly important because to this point, just to give one example outside the cultural area, the Canadian government has, under a lot of pressure, continued to say that we should limit the purchase of these trade and investment agreements around public and social services to limit their impact as drivers of privatization. If you go to the Romano report, identified by Romano is incredibly important in terms of preserving space for a public health system. If you talk about a common trade policy with the U.S., I mean, do we really expect the U.S. trade negotiator to go to the WTO and sort of fight for our Medicare system? I don't think so. So where does Atlantica fit into all this? Well, first of all, I mean, as clear, I mean, it's, again, all about open borders. And the illusion is that we can make this border disappear just by following the U.S. agenda. I guess you have to ask the question, where are the U.S. elites in the U.S. part of Atlantica that are going to bat for open Canadian access to their market? I don't see rallies in Boston against the softwood lumber deal. I mean, is the U.S. fishing industry sort of demanding easier access for the Canadian fishery products? I mean, it's just like the Security and Prosperity Partnership nationally. You got all of the Canadian elites assembled, and then who did they manage to sort of grab from the U.S.? Like a Michigan governor from three terms ago is about the best they can sort of really assemble. So, I mean, the notion that the U.S. corporate elite is itself committed to a fundamentally different relationship with Canada is incredibly problematic. I think the resources issue, I think, is a really important one for this region. I think it is very much on the table in the regional context. They haven't talked about this very much. They are talking about shared electricity grids. But there are, I think, some really key questions to be asked for Atlantic Canadians. I mean, when we look at the offshore oil and gas accords, we negotiated, or the provinces, as controllers of those resources, did negotiate the ability to have industrial offsets within the region. So as oil and gas development went ahead, a lot of the procurement requirements were to be filled within Canada. What's the Atlantica vision on that? Do they believe in having value added in Canada spinning off from oil and gas developments as further developments go forward? You take Voisey's Bay in Newfoundland. The provincial government there basically negotiated a smelter as the price of developing that resource. What do the people who are proposing Atlantica say about that? That we should require minerals, the jobs flowing from those minerals, to be based in Atlantic Canada rather than raw materials shipped out. What about the fishery? I haven't heard anybody say anything about the fishery. If we go back to the free trade agreement, that was actually rather a closely fought thing. There were claims coming from the U.S. They wanted free access to the Canadian fishery. We can't just reserve those Canadian fish for Canadian fishermen. I mean, that's protectionist. I haven't heard a word said about that. So I think the key principle that should really be put forward is that Atlantic Canadians should have control over their own resources to develop in the interests of the people in the region. And there's really very little point in having provincial control of oil and gas resources and mineral resources, for example, if we give the real control to transnational corporations. I mean, that provincial control comes with a purpose, I think, to develop those resources in the interests of the people in the region. I think, as has been said, this Atlantica initiative, the way they're putting it forward, is very squarely about further entrenching an anti-labor, corporate-driven model of economic development. So they're explicitly talking about weaker unions, even lower minimum wages, even lower taxes, lower social spending. So they're really talking about gaining competitiveness in an integrated market in a very particular way. And again, to come back to what I was saying, I think, again, the problem isn't trade per se, it's on what basis we trade. And I think the model of an economy we should be seeking is where employers and governments are investing very heavily in innovation and skills and research and development to really ramp up the knowledge basis of our economy to be producing much more sophisticated goods and services. And that requires good, decent labor standards, investment in people, not this race to the bottom that the Atlantica people are talking about. So my time's running out. I guess I did just want to flag one other really big point, which is that we're in a context now where the center of gravity in this global economy which we inhabit is very much decisively shifting away from Europe and North America towards developing Asia in particular. One striking fact, you know, the growth of the Chinese labor force over the last 10 years, the growth in the Chinese labor force is bigger than the North American and European labor force combined. Growth in the U.S., and that growth has been important for us in Canada, has been fueled by an incredible sort of run-up of household debt, of government debt. They run a huge balance of payments deficit. And the reality is the U.S. is going to be forced to rebalance that. So we're going to have a period ahead of us of much slower U.S. economic growth. I would suspect a much more protectionist U.S. in many ways to deal with that issue. And that really, I think, tells us that rather than further deepening this relationship, we need economic strategies that situate us in a much broader environment. So I had some other things to say, but I'll shut up and sit down and leave it to questions. Thank you.
Thank you.